Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. The prevailing narrative about Rolling Stone tends to treat the magazine as an artifact that emerged more or less fully formed in November of 1967, a professional rock publication that happened to launch in San Francisco and then happened to arrive at the right moment. Peter Richardson's new book, Brand New Beat, The Wild Rise of Rolling Stone Magazine, makes the more difficult argument. The magazine was not incidental to its geography, that its editorial formula was forged in direct response to what the mainstream media was failing to say about the Bay Area, and that one cannot account for its success without accounting for two things that tend to get flattened in the retelling: the counterculture it covered, and the media ecology against which it defined itself. Dr. Peter Richardson is uniquely positioned to make that case. Across four books, first on Kerry McWilliams, on Ramparts Magazine, on The Grateful Dead, and now on Rolling Stone, Dr. Richardson has been mapping the intellectual and cultural terrain of post-war California with specificity that much of its existing historiography, including Kevin Starr's otherwise magisterial Oxford series, has left strangely untouched. As Peter puts it in our conversation, these projects are, in aggregate, an attempt to understand the world he was born into. Now, our discussion ranges broadly. We trace his unlikely path from Anglo-Saxon philology and medieval literature into California cultural history. We return to McWilliams' thesis in California the Great Exception and ask whether it holds up now that the state reads less as an exception and more as a national template. We consider Hunter S. Thompson's oblique relationship to Haight-Ashbury counterculture, Kevin Starr's conspicuous silence on the 1960s, and we close, as always, with book recommendations. This is the History of California podcast. Let's meet our guest, Dr. Peter Richardson. To start off, Dr. Richardson, how'd you get into rock and roll?
Very indirectly. Of course, we were all steeped in it growing up. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay, and just daily life introduced you to a lot of rock and roll in a way that, yeah, I have to remind myself, it's not as central as it used to be, especially the youth culture. But I grew up reading Rolling Stone magazine. I read it as much for the film coverage, I think, now that I think about it, as I did for the rock and roll. But I was very aware of Rolling Stone magazine as a kind of tastemaker and an arbiter of what was cool, what wasn't cool, what was possible and in that world. And there was just something about that place and time, I think, that made that magazine and that kind of atmosphere distinctive. And it took me a long time to figure out that the world that I grew up in was a very specific and not very portable world, right? You couldn't take your experiences in the East Bay in the 60s and 70s and easily map them onto the experiences that people had, even people your age in Texas or Tennessee or New York even. So I've come to discover that most of the stuff I've been working on for the last 20 years or so is an attempt to understand the world that I was born into. So I was born in Berkeley in 1959.
Yeah. Did you ever see yourself on the stage versus writing about what was going on the stage?
No, never really. I didn't really feel like a performer. I still don't feel like a performer, but I have learned that stage and the kind of energy that it generates and the significance and identity that it generates for the people who are part of that scene is really important. It means a lot to people. I probably came to these topics very indirectly, but it took me a long time to figure out that people care a lot more about music than they care about a lot of the things that I care about. Of course, I care about music too.
Yeah.
But I've always had this sort of more voracious appetite for American popular culture. But of all those topics, I think sometimes that music means the most to people in just their sentimental education, if you will.
Yeah. You gestured this, but I want to ask a little more directly, which is, I think I romanticized parts of my childhood. And when I think back to certain technology or music, it has a lot more power and weight just because it was part of my childhood. How did being from that generation affect how you write about it? And a layer deeper, which is, how do you avoid that trap of romanticizing something that meant a lot to you as a kid?
That's a great question, a super, super important one. So I grew up, I didn't choose the music that was playing in our house. I had two older brothers and a younger sister, but the oldest brother was really responsible for going out and getting all the music that was playing in the house. So I never thought about it. I was very aware of it and I knew it over time, but it was a sonic wallpaper of our house. So it's just like the air that you breathe, or it's just there. But I think when it came to writing about this period, two things. First, as I say, I was really trying to understand the world that I was born into, and music journalism was a big part of that. And two, I think I also brought, and I'm not sure this is a disqualification, but I think what I brought to it was, I was slightly belated, right? I'm only 8 years old when Rolling Stone publishes its first issue of the magazine. I'm not an older baby boomer for whom, you know, which was squarely in the demographic for that magazine. I'm a little later. It's really my oldest brother's cohort, really, that is first exposed to this. And it's a huge breath of fresh air for them, especially if they're a little bit older than that, because they've been reading the mainstream media and wondering why they're not hearing more about the stuff that they know well and that matters a lot to them. We can get to that later if you like. But so I'm a little bit belated, but I do remember how important the magazine was. And I think if you're under 50, you might struggle with that a little bit, because, and we'll get into this more, but I think the fact that Rolling Stone comes on the scene is a breath of fresh air compared to the rest of the media ecology for this target market. This is like very exciting stuff. And I think if you're over 50, you never really knew a time in your personal life when Rolling Stone wasn't established, where Rolling Stone was in a way part of the establishment, at least in terms of choosing and curating the kind of music that you were listening to, or the way you thought about rock music and who was in the rock pantheon. Of course, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame isn't conceived until the early 1980s, and it's not constructed and finished until the 1990s. But there's a way that Rolling Stone was already shaping up in the public imagination, a kind of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It wasn't doing that at the beginning. That sort of comes out at the end of the first decade of their existence. At the beginning, they had a very different sort of starting point.
And guerrilla journalism versus institutional.
Yeah, they had a kind of founding conviction. And that conviction was that the counterculture and its music was the animating spirit of a social revolution already in progress. That period dies a quiet death, even before 1977. I graduated from high school in 1977. So I'm more in that kind of, we'll get to this too probably, but I'm more in that kind of Cameron Crowe, rock and roll 2.0 generation.
I was going to ask about what you thought about Almost Famous because you're working with similar themes and it's also charting that later period. What do you think that film does well and maybe could do better?
I think it's a very sweet, winsome coming of age story, and Rolling Stone magazine is a backdrop for it. It's an important backdrop. It's not just there. It's part of Cameron Crowe's origin story, a very important part of it. He wants to write about rock and roll and grows up with that dream. He gets to know Lester Bangs, an older rock writer who had written a lot for Rolling Stone and Cream and The Village Voice. So he has a kind of model for the kind of writing that he wants to do, but he's already separated a little bit from Lester Bangs generationally. That kind of raucous, unruly energy that Lester Bangs brought to his rock journalism is not really a huge part of Cameron Crowe's story, especially in Almost Famous. He's drawn to it strongly, but rock and roll's already changed a little bit by the time Cameron Crowe is writing about it. He's only 16 years old. when his first cover story in Rolling Stone comes out, which is amazing. So I liked the movie. I also liked his memoir, The Uncool, which just came out last year, which is a kind of, it's a kind of amplification of what, you know, Almost Famous. If you liked Almost Famous, you're probably going to like The Uncool. But it's also explaining the backstory behind what, you know, Almost Famous, the kind of true basis for that movie. So I think what it does well is it gets that kind of coming of age story. Really, there's the kind of self-deprecating sense of humor, which is really perfect. And I think, though, that what it might not cover, it never tries to cover, so I'm not knocking it for this, but there's something before this moment in rock history that I think Rolling Stone magazine crystallized for a lot of people. And that's what I mean when I say that Cameron Crowe is kind of rock and roll 2.0. Nobody would have characterized what Lester Bangs brought, that kind of energy, is sweet or winsome. It's the opposite of that. It's raucous and jagged and edgy. And that's not what I associate with Cameron Crowe. But that you can't knock him. He's been going with this kind of story now for quite some time, even though he's had a lot of other accomplishments and successes. He keeps circling back to this kind of youthful experience he had at Rock and Roll Magazine. And re-exploring that terrain, I think successfully. And the latest version, of course, is in his memoir.
Well, it's too bad that Philip Seymour Hoffman passed away, because I think a prequel of that kind of the Rock 1.0 might be a great idea for a film. And I'm sure Hollywood has already toyed with that.
No doubt.
I want to jump backwards into your career a little bit before we get to your book, because you've dabbled on a lot of things that have interest to me. What interested you about medieval literature? And do you think it's underrated these days? Or I haven't met very many people reading The Faerie Queen and Edmund Spenser these days.
No, it's fighting for its life, really, I think, probably in higher education right now. Certainly the older part of medieval literature and, of course, English departments in general, I think, there's a lot going on in higher ed right now, especially in the humanities. And
are we going to read Beowulf in 10 years? I don't know.
Yeah, I think even when I started teaching Anglo-Saxon literature, not as a grad student, but as an assistant professor, that was in 1991. It was already being crowded out by other topics.
Yeah. Well, what interested you about medieval literature? What'd you connect?
Well, that's the funny thing is that I never really was down with medieval literature. What I was down with was the history and structure of the English language. Mm. That was the topic I really was interested in. And so I took all the literature classes because that's how you learn the language, right? That's how you learn Old English and Middle English. And I also took classes on Old Norse, and I read the Icelandic sagas. And so I was very committed to it. But when you go out on the job market, well, by far, there are more jobs in medieval literature, and that's the kind of job that I landed. And so I had to repot myself or repurpose myself and get more into the literary aspects and the period and what was going on during that time. And I slowly managed that over the 10 years or so that I was teaching medieval literature, graduate courses on Beowulf and Canterbury Tales and stuff like that.
What's your favorite to read of medieval literature? If you were to recommend a book, if folks wanted to jump in.
I love the Icelandic family sagas. They read like Westerns to me. There's proto novels, and you read them in translation, of course, in Penguin Classics. A lot of people like those. There's a kind of grim, very understated humor to it. The style is super spare, and I really like those. I like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I think that's a fine Middle English poem.
Yeah.
With lots of great kind of human, there's a lot of humanity in that poem, although it's fantastical as well.
Yeah, I think it's good for people to go back, because Ivanhoe is, and all the kind of things that have come from that have really colored our picture. And so when you go back and read medieval literature, it's so much stranger and more interesting than you expect. It's not Game of Thrones. It's something else entirely. I think it's a lot of fun.
Game of Thrones wasn't out when I first started teaching, but I think for a long time I had what they call at Harvard, the frozen heroes approach to Anglo-Saxon literature, for example. That there was a kind of NFL film sort of feeling about the whole thing. What I realized later that it was that the more you study the culture, it had far more points of contact with the other great thing that I read when I was 14 years old, which was the godfather. There's a kind of, or we think of these kings and stuff, they're really warlords.
Yeah.
And these are war bands, and they have a lot of overlap between what was going on in the Middle Ages in Europe. There's a lot more, have a lot more in common with kind of mob wars than they do with these, with high literature, let's say. So, and I've always been very interested in organized crime history ever since I read The Godfather when I was, I think, in junior high school. And I love the movies, of course. And what, you know, when I started to realize that, it opened up that literature in a way, and I found myself more strongly attracted to it as I got more and more experience teaching that material.
I first became aware of your work through your biography of Carrie McWilliams, which I read and really enjoyed. I'm surprised by the paucity of biographies. He's such an influential and important person for the history of political thought in California and journalism and et cetera. Probably one of his more influential books is California, the Great Exception. Do you think McWilliams overstates California's uniqueness as just a kind of a journalistic kind of approach? What do you make of how he situates California relative to the rest of the United States?
Oh, I don't think he overplays the state significance. I think it has been very significant. I think the way we understand that significance has changed a little bit since McWilliams wrote that book in the late 40s. He called California the Great Exception. Other people later said it was the most American part of America. I think there's a way that that's also accurate, that the kind of the features of American culture, the characteristic features of that, of our culture, you can see very clearly in California usually. And very often you can see them here first, and then they spread to the rest of the country. And that's the part that I think has changed over the years, that California now is, you're more likely to hear people talking about California as the great avatar or the great template, because so many of the things that happen and trend in America happened first in California. And I think people, even people back east, for example, in New York, at the New York Times, for example, have kind of recognized that. And we see it now in the tech world. Yeah. Right. Most notably. But well before that, you could see it in the counterculture, and you could see it in media politics, which begins in earnest in California in the 1930s. McWilliams had a lot to say about that. You can see the Latino experience very clearly here. He wrote a book about that in the late 1940s. So he just was writing a book a year between 1939 and 1950. First-rate books. It's an unbelievable streak, really, especially when you consider he was also writing a ton of articles for The Nation and The New Republic, Harper's. So he was super, super versatile, super productive. Yeah, I was a little surprised, as you were, that somebody hadn't already written a biography of him. Yeah, I hadn't even heard of him. So I'm not surprised that people don't know about him. I grew up in California, and I didn't hear of him until I was in my 40s and started working as an editor at the Public Policy Institute of California. I just asked the director, the president and the director of research, what should I be reading as background? I had already been an English professor and I planned to keep up my reading and writing. And they said, oh, you should read everything by Carrie McWilliams. So that was a kind of moment when I realized that I had been missing something very important. And then I realized that he had a kind of cult following in California, and that a lot of people back east were aware of him, but they were aware of him as the editor of The Nation magazine. They didn't really even, many of them didn't even know that he had these books about California and the West in the 30s and 40s. He has this kind of split audience, the one that has to do with the journalism he did at The Nation magazine starting in the 50s and through the mid-70s. And the other is really tuned in. And I'm talking about people who write for a living about California, you know. Yeah. People who, you know, reporters and opinion op-ed people at the LA Times, for example, they've discovered he's a go-to person. And so people know about him. They don't really know just how, it's what an incredible public intellectual he was.
Yeah. Factors in the field, I'm sure, kind of reset a paradigm in how we think about labor. And it's
Yeah. I'm glad your book exists so people can revisit and really understand its significance.
That's a good example of, just to jump in quickly on the factories in the field. It wasn't just a way for us to understand about the history of farm labor in California. It certainly was that. And it was the first thing that sort of people read about that. But it was the way that people in the farm labor movement started thinking about themselves. That's the amazing thing, is that people like Fred Ross and Cesar Chavez were, especially Chavez, considered it part of his formal education.
Yeah.
So it was just had all this resonance, still does, for people who want to understand farm labor history.
Yeah, creating class consciousness in the kind of the Marxist sense. Let's jump to another important journalistic outlet you covered beyond Rolling Stone, which was Ramparts Magazine. My familiarity with it was those beautiful pictures of the Black Panther movement, some of those that became so iconic. How truly influential was Ramparts? Maybe for folks, because it is more of a niche magazine. So what was the magazine and what was the scale of its significance?
It was another thing that I was shocked that I'd never heard about growing up in California and being interested in its history and being a big reader, avid reader. But it was a magazine that started as a Catholic literary quarterly down on the peninsula in Menlo Park in 1962. So things begin to change a little bit when Warren Hinkle is hired as its publicist. And eventually, Warren takes over the magazine, becomes its editor, moves it to San Francisco, and it becomes basically an outlet for New Left reporting and commentary and investigative reporting and whistleblower stories. Big blockbuster stories about Vietnam and the CIA and things that had not been reported on accurately or deeply, or some in many cases at all. And so it had this, the staff writers, the major figures at the magazine were based in and around San Francisco, not New York or Washington, D.C. or the corridors of power. So they had this kind of outsider status, and they were young. They were in their 20s. And so there was a kind of brashness and a kind of showmanship also that was very important to its success. And its circulation skyrocketed pretty quickly, especially with young readers. And by young, I don't mean like teenagers. These were more young professionals. They did some research and found out some things about the demographic characteristics of the readers, what they did for a living and how much money they made and what other magazines they read and stuff like that. But they were definitely the new kid on the block, and they had an extraordinary ability to get the other major outlets of the time, and I'm thinking especially of the New York Times, to pick up their stories. And that was how they kept score. So they had a significance that far exceeded their own circulation, which was impressive. But they were also able to get other bigger outlets to pick up their stories and continue to report on them. And that was how Ramparts editors kept score. That was a huge success for them. So they continued to develop. They had some real challenges. They couldn't sell any ads, so they didn't have any ad revenue. They basically had the money that they made off of circulation, subscriptions and newsstand sales. And then they had these kind of millionaires who were willing to pay their bills and be associated with this kind of energetic voice, a new voice on the scene. They ran through a couple of private fortunes, and the other thing that happened that sort of was a setback for them was people started to imitate them. You know what I mean? There were new magazines that were doing the kinds of things that they were doing. So they declared bankruptcy for the first time in 1969. They reorganized, Warren Hinkle left. They reorganized and were continued. They then ousted Robert Scheer, who was the editor-in-chief for a little while after the reorg. And then David Horowitz, of all people, and Peter Collier were kind of running the show there. But they finally had to, at a lower altitude, and then they finally had to close up for good in 1975.
Yeah. We're just going to keep hopping from lily pad to lily pad of your bibliography, which is a fascinating tour. We just lost Bob Weir last month. What's your kind of personal eulogy for Bob and his impact that he had on music, and connecting it to broader history of the Grateful Dead is fine too.
He was beloved, and that I think became very clear right away. It was no surprise, of course, to people in the Deadhead community, which is still thriving 30 years after the Grateful Dead as such dissolved. And there's something important happening there, that the Dead's commitment to its own community. And they never really tried to create it or consciously grow it or shape it, but they certainly fostered it with some of the things that they, some of the decisions that they made. And also their own kind of, the way they invited their fans inside the project in a way that the Beatles never did or the Rolling Stones never did, and certainly Bob Dylan never did. What was interesting to me about the Grateful Dead, and Bob Weir's part in it, was the way they made these kind of commitments that were very foundational to everything that they did. And one was to this kind of ecstatic rapture, which they were shooting for every night that they played live. And these tours, the mobility that comes with the tours, but also their kind of fascination with the open road, which they inherited from the Beats. And then because they weren't in Neil Cassidy's Ford sedan, they were touring and the venues got bigger and bigger. So they were there was much more public space for the expression of the kind of values that they were committed to. But the thing above all was their commitment to community. And that commitment paid off in so many ways for them over the years and made it possible for them to continue to tour and play and record long after their peers in the San Francisco counterculture flashed across the American scene. The Dead were still rumbling on and actually growing 20, 25 years into that operation. So no top 10 singles until the late 80s. They'd already been around for more than 20 years. And here they are. They dissolved with the death of Jerry Garcia in 1995. But here we are still talking about them, partly because John Mayer works with Bob Weir and at first Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart. And with Dead & Company, they just sold, I think I read a couple of years ago, they did 30 concerts at Sphere in Las Vegas, and they sold $130 million worth of tickets.
Wild.
30 years after the band formally dissolves. So that's what I mean by this kind of durability and this kind of popular success that just keeps rumbling on. I think you can trace all that back to the kind of their commitments that they made at the very beginning. The lineup changed, the music changed, the instruments changed, the sound system changed, their business practices changed and evolved, but their basic fundamental commitments to ecstatic rapture in community and then this kind of taking it on the road, I think those were very stable, those commitments. And I think it created the sort of success that we still marvel at. Remember in 2015, when the Core Four, Phil Lesh, Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann played, they only booked 5 shows and they sold out in about 27 seconds. Two were in Santa Clara and 3 were in Chicago. And they sold $53 million worth of tickets for 5 shows, which was even more. Of course, they were bigger venues than Sphere. So they shattered all these records, these box office records, shattered all the pay-per-view records, and which amazed everybody except everybody in the Deadhead community.
They all knew that, yeah, it's such a fascinating story. And
so California too, right? And American. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that sort of got me deeper into thinking about the San Francisco counterculture. And the Ramparts magazine was never part of the counterculture per se. In fact, Warren Hinkle wrote a kind of slightly disparaging account of Haight-Ashbury in The Summer of Love, 1967, when Haight-Ashbury was attracting national attention, intensive coverage from most of the major news outlets in the country, magazines, TV networks, newspapers. Everybody was sending somebody out to Haight-Ashbury to get the story. And that I started thinking harder about that period, what was going on during that period, in part, partly from the research I did on Ramparts magazine, but then rounded out by some of the things I learned studying the Grateful Dead.
My next topic, I'm hesitant to open up, because once you start talking about Hunter S. Thompson, it's hard to stop. And so let me just ask one specific and direct question about him. How would you, and I've wrestled with this because I've read a lot of his writing, how would you describe or diagnose his relationship to the counterculture? Well, it seemed complicated and nuanced. It wasn't just supporting or against or however general ideas. So it's more kind of complicated by critique, but also appreciation. And so how would you describe it?
First, you're exactly right. It's not a straight, he's not a hippie.
Yeah. Right?
Let's start with that. So he's living in San Francisco when Haight-Ashbury starts to attract national attention. He never usually lived in cities. He didn't really love, he loved traveling the cities, especially on somebody else's dime. He loved urban pleasures, but he usually lived in these kind of bucolic outposts, including the one I'm sitting in right now, Glen Ellen, up in Sonoma County. He lived here for a while. He lived in Big Sur for a while, but he usually gave the cities a wide berth, at least in terms of choosing his own home. Of course, he was just outside Aspen for many years. But I would argue that his literary formation happens in San Francisco, that he becomes Hunter Thompson, Hunter S. Thompson, while he's in San Francisco. His first big story, his first best-selling book, On the Hell's Angels. So, you know, that's when he's living in San Francisco on Parnassus, over near the hospital, UC San Francisco.
Yeah.
So he's got this great kind of perch to observe Haight-Ashbury. He writes about Haight-Ashbury for New York Times Magazine around the Summer of Love. He's the guy that the New York Times Magazine picks to write about what's happening in Haight-Ashbury. And because he's lived there, he has some insight on it. But I think he misses bits of the story that turn out to be very important. And later he says, I didn't love that. I didn't love that piece. He's an enthusiastic participant in the city's drug culture, in the counterculture's drug culture. So there's that. He has a crush on Grace Slick, the lead singer for Jefferson Airplane. He befriends Ken Kesey, who has a very important role in the origin growth of the San Francisco counterculture. And then later in life, 40 years after he's moved out of San Francisco, he looks back on his time in San Francisco and he says, that was my peak era. That was it for me. So that's what I mean when I say it was an important part of his literary formation. I think the counterculture was an important part of that.
Yeah.
So I don't think he would have had the success he had absent the counterculture. And one way to just test that is to say, who was publishing him? It was Rolling Stone magazine. He creates Gonzo at Scanlon's magazine with Warren Hinkle, who he had come to know when Warren was editing Ramparts magazine. And he admires Ramparts and he wants to work with Warren. The only problem with Scanlon's is it goes out of business after publishing 8 issues. Now he needs a new outlet. And it turns out to be Rolling Stone magazine, where both co-founders of Rolling Stone magazine had worked at Ramparts before that. They know who he is. And then when he comes out with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas November 1971, Jan Wenner, one of those co-founders, the most important figure at Rolling Stone magazine in its first 50 years, he gets it. He realizes, I'm going to just lash this Gonzo journalism to my masthead. And even though Thompson's older than, about 10 years older than the typical Rolling Stone.
How old was he when he was in that kind of peak era? What was his age range?
He was born in, I think, 1938. He's 10 years older almost than Jan Wenner and most of the people who are writing. He didn't finish college. Most of them had gone to, a lot of them went to UC Berkeley or San Francisco State College at the time. And so he's not one of those people. He's a veteran. He doesn't quite fit the profile at Rolling Stone, but he lives in the Rocky Mountains. So he doesn't quite fit the bill when it comes to Rolling Stone and the kind of people they were hiring. Nevertheless, you know, during this period, he is by far the most important writer at Rolling Stone magazine. And he doesn't write about music. that tells you something about him, but it also tells you something about the magazine.
Absolutely. I said this was going to be the last topic before we jumped into the book, but then I realized I still had to ask you about Kevin Starr, because I read your article. It was fascinating. Kevin Starr is a regular kind of character on the show as being the kind of librarian or great survey writer of California history. But it was interesting kind of reading about the lacuna at the center, which is not covering this major paradigm shifting event in California history. So let me ask you this just really directly then. So if he had wrote, to quote from your article, if he had wrote Smoke and the Dream, which is would be his tome on this period of counterculture, what do you think his thesis statement would have been about that time?
I think he would have been critical of it mostly. I don't think he would have been completely sympathetic to him. He was a very savvy historian. He knew that there are shades and nuances and complexities that you can't dismiss. But I think there was something about the period and the people and the movements that didn't set quite, they weren't quite for him. And he said this open, I'm not putting words in his mouth. He wrote a little bit more, he felt a little bit more connected to the 50s and some of the things that were going on then. Usually that doesn't disqualify a historian from writing about the period. But I think he might have been reluctant to write critically about things that meant a lot to other people that he knew and may have respected. And so I think he just gave it a pass and he just left it for other people to do. We don't know exactly why he left the 60s and 70s open that way. Now, what we do know is that he wrote a lot about that period, but not in his kind of magisterial series for Oxford University Press. Well, I think one volume came out from Random House, but he's the guy who taught us how to think about California history in many ways in the modern period. So the fact that he decided not to write about this period, I thought needed some investigation. And then I found out that he had written almost 6 articles a week for San Francisco Examiner. And most of that material is not available online. I had to go up and find it in his archive at the California State Library, where he was the California State Librarian. It's not like he was hiding it.
Yeah.
It was there. And of course, anybody who read the San Francisco Examiner for those years read Kevin and knew exactly what he thought about the period and what was going on in San Francisco, culturally, politically, religiously, and so on. So I got in there and read all that stuff just to find out what he was thinking at that time. The other thing I realized was that he, in a very kind of California way or American way, he refashioned himself mid-career. The things that preoccupied him early on sort of gave way to this new role that he embraced when he began to write this great series of books about California history. The first came out, then there was a kind of gap, and then he went back and did the second and subsequent volumes. And as he did, he began to become a kind of He wasn't the op-ed guy with the sharp opinions. He was more of he had a broader view of the state and its history, and he grew into a new role, I think. And that's the role that we all know. But for a little while there, he was a guy at San Francisco Examiner, which is conservative Hearst paper, you know, hitting some of these points pretty hard. Not always. A lot of the articles were just celebrations of what was happening in the city and the kinds of things that kind of he enjoyed and that did it for him. He loved the city. There's no doubt about that. Even when he taught at USC, he was a university professor of history, just a university professor at USC for many years. He never moved away from San Francisco.
And I've done that before. It's hard to leave that city.
Yeah, no, I know. Kevin was very important to me, important to my thinking about California. He helped me with my Karen McWilliams project. I sent it to him blind. I'd never met him before. He left a message on my answering machine. Man, I really wished I had kept that message. It was such a shot in the arm. It was such an affirmation of what I was trying to do. And I'll always love Kevin for that.
Yeah. Let's jump into Brand New Beat, which is your new book about Rolling Stone. I want to start by setting the stage. I think we have perceptions of what San Francisco was like in the 1960s, and some of them are accurate. Some of them are created by kind of romanticization. Some are created by movies and media. But if you could give people just in broad strokes a sketch of the milieu that Rolling Stone was born into.
The first issue comes out in November of 1967, and that was a very eventful year. And it was a culmination of some years before that. But I think prior to, say, 1964, what can you say about San Francisco? It had always encouraged a kind of bohemianism. There was never a kind of official high culture that dominated the city. So if you go back and look, you see these kind of benchmark events and legal trials and the obscenity trial of Allen Ginsberg and such. His vindication sent out a signal. Wouldn't be the end of obscenity trials. Lenny Bruce would go through one in San Francisco a little bit after that. But the reputation that the city had was a place where beat writers and labor unionists and people that would have been on the fringes of power in other cities actually had a kind of place at the table. Harry Bridges, for example. Years, decades of the political establishment trying to silence this guy did work. So the people who started Rolling Stone were very aware of that history, wave after wave of bohemianism, beginning in the 19th century, extending into the 20th century with figures like Jack London in and around San Francisco, and then into the 50s, where you get the San Francisco Renaissance, the Beats, Ken Kesey. So there is this kind of strain of bohemian culture that I think is quite developed by the time Rolling Stone magazine comes on the scene.
Let me ask a question, because I know one of the kind of part of your core thesis of the book is that Rolling Stone had to arrive in the Bay Area. But I also have thought there is a developed bohemian culture in New York City. So I guess in your mind, it is a kind of counterfactual, if Rolling Stone was started in New York as opposed to San Francisco, what do you think it would be similar in some ways, given some cultural similarities? Or do you think that it would be distinct enough, given all the kind of unique attributes of San Francisco?
I think that's a great question. It's also multifaceted, but there were rock magazines in New York, so we don't have to ask it as a hypothetical.
Yeah. I think, how were they different?
They were different in a couple ways. They didn't focus on the counterculture and its music. They were rock magazines. Cream would be one that started in Detroit. But they didn't really see the full value of what was happening in San Francisco during this time. That what happened with the development of the counterculture in San Francisco, you can't really understand Rolling Stone magazine if you don't think a little bit about the counterculture and especially this kind of what was happening locally. So I would identify two non-musical sources. One was the free speech movement in Berkeley. Both of the co-founders of the magazine reported on that directly and had a side. They were for the free speech movement. And they wrote about that in the Jan Wenner in the Daily California in the campus paper and Ralph Gleason in his column in the San Francisco Chronicle. So that was one. The other was Ramparts. Both of them worked at Ramparts and came out of that. They saw how successful it was. They saw the kind of energies that were loosed by Ramparts magazine, how to break a story, how to publicize a story, how to play against the mainstream media, which was a very important part of Rolling Stone's success, I think.
How did Rolling Stone straddle that tension between fan culture and serious journalism? I think in Almost Famous, that's one of the kind of the strings that Cameron Crowe pulls on, which is, we all love rock and roll, but this is serious journalism. And how do you maintain that boundary? How did Rolling Stone do that successfully in your mind?
They worked very hard to distinguish themselves from all the other forms of music journalism that were out there. It wasn't the first magazine to write about rock. People had been writing about Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, and Buddy Holly, and so on. The Beatles. The Beatles come to San Francisco in August of 1966, more than a year before the first issue of Rolling Stone comes out. So what Jan and Ralph did was they were like, we want it to be professional, first of all. We don't want it to look like an underground newspaper. We don't want that voice. We don't want that look. We want it to be, but in this sense, that's what Ramparts did too. It was a good looking magazine. And they used the same designs actually as Ramparts, partly because they didn't have any designers and they were both working for Ramparts, and they asked the people at Ramparts if they could borrow their designs. So that was part of it, that they distinguished themselves from the underground papers. They also distinguished themselves from the teen magazines. Nothing, they didn't want to be mistaken for 16 or Tiger Beat or something like that, or even Teen Set, which was actually quite a good magazine during this time, edited by a woman who would eventually join the staff at Rolling Stone magazine. No, we're doing something different over here. We're focusing on the counterculture and its music. Now, they did overlap with places like the Village Voice and Cream and so on, but Cream was never set up to break a big story like Altamont or the Manson family murder trial or any of those stories, or to publish somebody like Hunter Thompson. Yeah. So the effort from the beginning, from the onset, was the idea is that we're not just a rock magazine. They were always more than, they were the best rock magazine, but they are always more than a rock magazine. So they're a creature of the counterculture. The counterculture is unfolding around them. At this point, San Francisco is a global rock capital. And that had happened very quickly. There was no real rock and roll scene in San Francisco, even in the early 60s. But all of a sudden, it's Jefferson Airplane and Big Brother and the Holding Company and Blue Cheer and the Grateful Dead and Quicksilver Messenger Service. And they're charting. All of these bands are getting signed. And they're, so something's happening in and around San Francisco. And most of the mainstream outlets, when they come and check out the counterculture, they disparage it. Those are negative stories. So from the beginning, the Rolling Stone is working against the tide, if you will, of the mainstream media.
That was my next question for you, Peter, was just how self-conscious the editors of Rolling Stone were about their political role. Was it something that they had a self-awareness of, that they were serving this kind of role to think about non-mainstream political actors, or was it something that was just generated through the work that they were doing?
A little bit of both, but they were quite conscious of it. They, early on, were staking out political positions. In the very first issue, Ralph Gleason, who has a column called Perspectives, calls out racial double standards in the U.S. media. Now, that's not something you're going to see in Billboard magazine. That's the other kind of magazine that they wanted to distinguish themselves from, was a trade magazine. We're not a trade magazine. We're not a teen magazine. And we're not a political magazine. Right. But they do a lot of political stuff. And I think that was an important part of the editorial formula. It was also critical to their survival, because the music labels provided all the advertising money, which allowed them to do other kinds of stories. So they leveraged that, their musical niche, their specialty, their strong suit. They leveraged that to do other kinds of stories and broaden the editorial formula and their offering and their impact. So the very first National Magazine Award that they land, it's for stories that appeared in 1970. And I think the award is actually conferred in 1971. But it's on the Altamont concert of December 1969 and the Manson murder trials in Los Angeles. That article also appears in 1970. And when the awards committee confers this award, they say they're telling the truth about the dark side of the counterculture. So even though they're a creature of the counterculture, they would never be nearly as successful if they didn't tap into that movement and its power. They also have a kind of critical distance from it, a professional one. They're not cheerleaders for the counterculture. But if you don't understand the counterculture, you'll never understand why they were as successful as they were.
Yeah. That is a natural segue to my next question, is when the counterculture revolution ended, what happened to Rolling Stone? Maybe, because that's a kind of a really interesting point in terms of its identity and what its role is. And if the revolution's gone, something that was born in the revolution, how does it change?
Great question. And it happens in the first 10 years.
Yeah.
So people stop talking about the counterculture. Now, I'm going to argue, and I do in the book, that the counterculture doesn't go away with the end of the Vietnam War. But for many magazines and media outlets, they stop reporting on it as if it's a kind of urgent issue. I'm going to argue, and a lot of U.S. historians agree, that the counterculture has a kind of long tail. The 60s has a long tail. Things are kind of things that occur in the 60s spread out over subsequent. The significance of what happens in the 60s does not end on December 31st, 1969, right? It yeah. continues to shape American culture and society and politics in many ways. They have to pivot away from this notion of that they really believed in, and that much of their journalism was based on this conviction that the counterculture was going to transform American culture in the fullness of time somehow. That doesn't happen fully, right, in the way that they think, and certainly doesn't happen as quickly as they think. And so by 1975 or so, when Cameron Crowe is writing about the magazine, they pivot away from it. That's the idea that dies a quiet death. Even Rolling Stone's own publications say that. Not many. One of them does. But now, so what's going to take its place? They're going to broaden their coverage of political stuff. This is when Hunter Thompson's really reaching his peak. Political commentary, political satire, invective, gonzo, right? Timothy Krause is writing about media. So there's a little bit of media criticism. They do more stories about crime. They do more stories about the environment. Now, crime, I don't mean any old crime, the kind of crimes that would be interesting to their audiences. Things having to do with drugs and the drug culture, environmental stuff, you know, that rises to criminality. They do a very important story, Howard Cohn does, on Karen Silkwood and nuclear power and some of the improprieties surrounding nuclear power at this one Oklahoma facility. That ends up becoming a book by Howard Cohn. And then, of course, a major Hollywood movie with Meryl Streep and Cher. They're looking for other things. And then musically, I think what they're doing is they're starting to think a little bit more about historicizing rock and roll, reflecting on the history of rock and roll. Now, in 1967, nobody thought that was worth doing. It wasn't important enough to the culture. But by 1977, people are starting to think about, well, wait a minute, rock is widely accepted in the culture at large. It's accepted as part of the entertainment industry. It's not a fad or a pathology or something that's going to go away. It's here and it's established. And it's so now they're starting to think about rock history and historicizing rock, but also who's going to be in the rock pantheon? That becomes a question at Rolling Stone magazine. Like, who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which doesn't exist yet? But they're imagining who these top acts are. And Cameron Crowe recently, within the last 5 years, gave an interview in which he said, I understood that part, and I wanted my favorite bands to be in that club, to be in that pantheon. You know, and he's thinking about the Allman Brothers and Deep Purple and Humble Pie, all the bands that he covered for the magazine. Now, this is after Dylan and the Stones and the Beatles, right? So they had already ascended into heaven, rock and roll heaven. Now, who else was going to join them there? And that's what Cameron Crowe thought he was doing at that time.
Yeah. Let's do some 20,000 foot kind of perspective questions now. If Rolling Stone was never created, how might the Bay Area have been different? I asked an inversion of this question before. Now I'm curious, like, what did Rolling Stone do to make the Bay Area made it, and then in that kind of virtuous cycle affected it as well?
I mean, there was a kind of media transformation as well as a transformation of live music and live shows. And all of that was changing at the same time. The media was changing at the same time. Radio was changing, right? We were getting, in the Bay Area, we were getting away from the top 40 format and getting into deep tracks kind of thing, whole albums sometimes. And from stations that really sounded almost smelled like the counterculture. You could almost take in it as a kind of sensory experience. And I remember that very well, listening to KSAN or KSAN when it was a counterculture rock station. And they had news. And so this transformation was complete. It was the way we listened to music. It was the way it was produced, the way it was staged, the way it was marketed. All of that was changing at the same time. And I would argue that Rolling Stone was a central part of that transformation. It lifted up the scene. There was a lot of interest in the scene already, but Rolling Stone lifted up and gave it a kind of specificity and shape and made other people interested in what was happening around here. But some of the writers for Rolling Stone accused John Wenner of a kind of what John Landau, now Bruce Springsteen's manager, calls a kind of San Francisco nationalism. It was too provincial. And it was too much about what was happening here. The LA editor said the same thing. But because they were publishing people like John Landau, who was writing about Stax Records and Motown and stuff like that, they really didn't sink into that kind of provincialism in quite the way that John was concerned about. And the LA people got their due as well. So the magazine was broadening the perspective. It wasn't just a Bay Area magazine, but it did help make San Francisco a global rock capital. Its success was such that people wanted to come to San Francisco and check out what was happening. I mean, the Beatles wanted to come to San Francisco and check out what was happening. And Rolling Stones wanted to finish their 1969 American tour in the Bay Area. They wanted part of that kind of countercultural cachet. And I think Rolling Stone was part of that kind of glamour, if you will. It's a funny word to apply to some of these bands, but there was nothing less glamorous in some ways than the Grateful Dead, for example. But there was a kind of authenticity that was very important to the counterculture. And it was important even to the Rolling Stones to tap into that.
Do you think California's capable of housing a counterculture today with our wealth and our challenges and cost of housing and all those kinds of things? Is counterculture just a historically specific moment, or does California still have that capacity in your mind?
The counterculture, which was named by a Bay Area social critic named Theodore Roszak, so beatniks, hippies, all of these terms were generated in the San Francisco Bay Area. And to answer your question, I don't think the kind of counterculture that Theodore Roszak was writing about in the late 1960s is going to emerge again. I don't think anything exactly like that. First of all, you got to remember something like 50% of the American population was under 25 years of age in 1965. So there was this democratic kind of power behind the counterculture. I think the Vietnam War was very important in shaping and powering the counterculture, which was a shapeless, it wasn't a kind of unified, cohesive movement with a single message. It was more, you know, Roszak compared it to a medieval crusade with people, this kind of shambling progress where people were joining and dropping out along the way. So I don't imagine anything like that is going to come back. But lately I've been thinking about something, and it's taken on a little bit more power, at least in the way I think about it. And that is that the thing that Roszak was talking about, the counterculture that he was describing, he said, and it was in his subtitle, that what he liked about the counterculture was that they opposed what he called the technocracy, this form of this kind of corporate, spirit-killing form of government that tapped into tech and it thrived really on intense surveillance and social control. Yeah. To me, that feels like it's ripped out of the headlines right now. If there is another counterculture, you would only have to update that part of what Roszak was writing about 50, 60 years ago. And Roszak was a shrewd observer of big tech in Silicon Valley. And he wrote about that in the 1980s. And he basically was like, he didn't say it this way, but basically I'm for the hippies when they're opposing the technocracy. When they're aiding the technocracy, not so crazy about it. And so I think there might be, it wouldn't surprise me if there was a movement, especially among young people. Here I am, age 67, scrolling, posting, whatever, doing all, I'm online all day long. Wouldn't surprise me though, if a bunch of young people finally just said, what are we doing here? What's big tech doing for us that we can't do better for ourselves? And so I have some anecdata that some young people are actually looking at it that way. And I think, I feel like Rozak did when he was writing about the hippies and counterculture and the technocracy in the 60s. He looked at the hippies and because they were averse to the technocracy at that time, he was like, they have healthy instincts. That's a healthy instinct. I'm going to support that. And so he didn't go along with all the other critics of the counterculture at that time, even though there was a lot to criticize, certainly. But there was something about it that he liked and that he wanted to promote. And I think we could find some piece of that if we look around today as a kind of foundation for another kind of counterculture.
Are there writers or publications today that you think are carrying on the tradition of Rolling Stone in the capacity that it had in those early days? Or do you think that writing doesn't exist much anymore?
So much of the success of Rolling Stone at that time depended on what was going around at the time. I mentioned some of the things that people found in Rolling Stone, and one of them was, behind all of them was this idea that the mainstream media is not telling us the truth. They're not telling us the truth about the stuff we care the most about. They're not telling us the truth about the war in Vietnam. They're not telling us the truth about the dangers of marijuana. They're not telling us the truth about ourselves, about the counterculture, to the extent that there's this kind of what Rozak called a kind of radical disaffiliation from the mainstream culture. Yes, I can see that. Do I see it right now? I'm probably not the right person to ask. I'm consuming a lot of media, but I don't see anything out there that looks or feels like Rolling Stone did in 1967, insofar as it's just saying not only no to the mainstream culture and the kind of radical disaffiliation by the counterculture, but also look at this. This is what you've been waiting for. This is a yes, not just a no, but a yes, right? A yes to what was happening with the counterculture and its music at that time. So you might have to give me a little bit more time to think about it. I probably have been enjoying at some level the kind of media that I just described, but it's not coming to me. And I don't think Rolling Stone magazine today is offering that.
Yeah, there might be some niche writers on Substack or some other places doing that, or people putting out zines, but not quite at the scale. I've got two questions for you.
Yeah.
So first one is, I like to ask the people I interview how the research they did for their books or publications changes or alters their perspective of California history. Were there things that you did in this research process for this book that either surprised you about California history or changed kind of assumptions or priors you had about it?
I think we've touched on it already, but one of the things that I am clearer about now because of the research and the writing is that you can't understand Rolling Stone magazine if you don't understand two other things. One is the counterculture, right? Which we've talked about a little bit. It's become a stereotype. It's become a kind of two-dimensional, everybody thinks they know what it is. And then you realize it's a mile wide and an inch deep, right? So I think a more familiarity with what was happening with the counterculture at that time is super important understanding, not only the magazine, but what it accomplished. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, you have to understand, I think, is what the mainstream media was doing during that time. And you have to study that. And if you read Joan Didion, and if you read Hunter Thompson, if you read some of these other, if you read Time magazine from 1967, why would you really, unless you were writing a book like today? But if you get a feeling for what the mainstream was doing at that time, you can realize what they weren't doing and how that created an opening for a magazine called Rolling Stone as a magazine. and then everything they did was reporting on the things that interested them. And either overtly or covertly, they were basically saying, notice you're not getting this from the mainstream media. You're not going to find this in the Saturday Evening Post or the Washington Post. So there was that. And I think, so it clarified for me the importance of a healthy media ecology where you have all kinds of players, big ones, little ones, niche ones, general ones. Jan Wenner was, of course, trying to take this niche and turn it into something much more general that would have broader appeal beyond people's interest in rock music and rock musicians. So that has crystallized for me during that time. The other thing, there's two other things quickly. One was this letter from Ellen Willis to Ralph Gleason in 1970. It was so on point. And finding this letter and reading it in these papers, which I read in a kind of New Jersey warehouse, secure one, so in a windowless room going through these boxes of material. And then you get something from Ellen Willis, who writes to Ralph Gleason, the elder of the two co-founders, who wants her to write for the magazine, and he's, I'm not gonna write for him. And then she gives this kind of point-by-point list of all the reasons she's not gonna write, even though it's the best rock magazine at that time, and she's writing about rock. It's just such a kind of little time capsule. She ends up writing for Rolling Stone magazine 5 years later. But this is such a, she's such a good writer. And it's so clear and forceful about what her objections to Rolling Stone is. I just really love that. And the other thing I think that I learned, and I partly learned it about California culture, although it was also about New York City, was the extent to which the magazine wrote about gay culture. Nobody talks about this as something that Rolling Stone was doing at that time. There have been other histories of the magazine, of course, and I love them all. But I think what I was surprised by was going through the issues and thinking, oh man, here's another really incredible article about the gay community in San Francisco, the gay community in New York, or gender bending, let's say, in the music business. Don't forget, Elton John comes out in a Rolling Stone interview, basically. The early stuff on David Bowie, it's just, and then the reader's reaction to that. It was not smooth. It did not go over with everybody. And just the way the magazine and its stories let things come to the surface where you could look at them and say, is this landing? How is this landing with readers at the time? Much less people who never picked up a copy of Rolling Stone in the first place.
Yeah. Given how much of our media landscape is owned by private equity and corporate interests, I don't think pushing the envelope like that is really in the business of, but that's a whole different discussion. I want to conclude the podcast with book recommendations, which we conclude each episode with. What are a few books, either on the topics we've discussed today or things that interest you, that you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Oh, man, there's so many good ones on California culture that I would like to recommend and California history, but I'll try to keep it a little closer to home. Let's see. I love everything about Jerry Garcia. If you're trying to understand the counterculture quickly, that's a really good way to do it. One of my friends, Nick Merriweather, who was the Grateful Dead archivist at UC Santa Cruz, said, you can't really understand the 20th century in America without understanding the counterculture. And one of the most efficient ways to understand the counterculture is to study the Grateful Dead. And I would go a little bit further. If the Grateful Dead is the part that stands for the whole, for the San Francisco counterculture, Garcia is the kind of part that stands for the whole, for the dead. Really love, if you want to put a face on the San Francisco counterculture, Jerry Garcia's, I think, is my good one. What else? The political history you asked about San Francisco during this time, what was happening. There's a biography of Philip Burton that is incredible for explaining what was happening politically at this time. It goes a little further back than the founding of, or than the counterculture of the founding of the magazine. But again, it's one of those things where you can really understand, especially understand the Democratic Party in the second half of the 20th century. Highly recommend that. It's called Rage for Justice. Give me some hints.
Yeah, really anything. I'm just more curious to pick your brain on maybe some books that were influential in giving you a big picture outside of Kevin Starr of mm-hmm. California.
Oh, let me mention one more about that's closer to home. And that is Bill Graham Presents, which is an oral history, but it's an oral biography of Bill Graham. Another, it's astounding. There's so many great stories in there. And you really can understand how Bill Graham, who was not a hippie, understood what the counterculture and its music had the potential to do. And then he becomes, of course, this famous impresario for rock music. But so that's a book that Bill Graham did with Robert Greenfield. Love that book and highly recommend that to everyone. Peter Coyote, who was a digger and part of the San Francisco meme troupe, wrote a memoir called Sleeping Where I Fall. Really love that. And these are easy reads, right? These are not scholarly bunch of footnotes and stuff. These are people telling their own story in very interesting ways. Everything about Ken Kesey, of course, will help you understand the counterculture and its music in the Bay Area and California. Going back a little further, I have this one. It's actually about a moment in 1934 that I totally love. And it's called Campaign of the Century by Greg Mitchell. And it's about Upton Sinclair's run for governor in 1934. And it's got this fantastic structure where it opens on the day Sinclair receives the Democratic Party nomination for governor. And it goes day by day until the general election, looking in on famous people all around the country, William Randolph Hearst, FDR, a bunch of FDR's cabinet members, Ty Cobb, who turns out the baseball legend, who was an ardent kind of Republican and very active in politics in California, Adolf Hitler, who William Randolph Hearst visited that year. It's great. It's a big, it's a whopper. Give yourself some time. But I really like it. It's by Greg Mitchell. City of Nets by Otto Friedrich.
About, oh, one of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. So once I got started,
you could go on.
I'm going to walk this thing out to my library and start telling you everything. So
what if you were to get a class on the counterculture, you wanted to assign a film to give students a picture? What film would you assign to the class?
There's a documentary called The Summer of Love. I think it appeared in the American Experience series. That is gives you some has some great kind of background and some footage. You get some visual information about what some these events look like and what these people look like. And Joel Selvin's one of the talking heads. I recommend him on this topic. He's very active and has participated in a lot of these efforts and has written his own books about this period and others that I recommend. Theodore Roszak is in that film. He's one of the called upon to explain the counterculture and its appeal during this time and does a good job. His book came out in 1969. This movie doesn't come out until the 90s, I think. But that's one that I would highly recommend. There's a good film that was made by a guy named Stephen Talbot on Ken Kesey that I used to show my class all the time. That really gives you a feeling for the Kesey's a transitional figure from the Beats to the hippies, but he was certainly an important part of the San Francisco scene in the mid-1960s. Those are the two that popped to mind that I used to show a lot in my classes in San Francisco. Oh, sorry. Berkeley in the 60s is another one that I highly recommend and always showed in my classes. And that was about Berkeley campus activism, obviously, which is only one piece of the puzzle, but it also spends some time on what was happening with the Black Panthers in Oakland and with the counterculture in San Francisco. And I think that's important is to keep those distinct. Those weren't the same thing, but they were connected. The Berkeley campus activists, the Black Panthers in Oakland, and the hippies in San Francisco.
Okay. To close, what are you working on next?
I'm not quite sure yet. I'm batting around some ideas. I'm thinking about doing something more, but it would be not a traditional book, but more of an anthology on Theodore Roszak with my friend and colleague, Michael Kramer. I think Roszak's fascinating, not only for the stuff on the counterculture, but also for what he said about Silicon Valley in the 80s, where he just was like, you would do well to be a techno-skeptic. He was not a techno-utopian or even a techno-optimist. So he had a lot of very interesting things to say about Silicon Valley, which was emerging, of course, in the 1980s, and then connecting it back to the stuff that he had done on the counterculture. So maybe something on Rozak like that. And then I have some other topics banging around in my head that I'm not sure I'm going to come back to the San Francisco counterculture one more time. I never tire of saying that this book was the fourth volume in my trilogy about this, about the San Francisco. How many books can you stuff into a trilogy?
That's just keep going, Peter. Well, and the book that we discussed today, amongst many, is Brand New Beat, The Wild Rise of Rolling Stone Magazine. Peter Richardson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. I'm not going to